He does say that in at least two of his writings. By the way,
so that goes back to my original question, which is what I was looking for an answer on, is why does this creator who has access to all of the world's evidence available, certainly, choose some of the poorest? We just got to take everybody's word for it.
What should he have done? Should he have, like, put this on television?
Cross on the moon.
Pardon me?
Cross on the moon.
A cross on the moon. Oh, you mean something.
you mean doing something where everybody in the world can see it.
Right. Okay, that's what you're saying.
Not even just everybody in the world. Something that doesn't require, you see, like what Reggie was talking about earlier, there have been hosts of studies on sleep paralysis, sleep dementia, and these are experienced by people of a variety of different faiths, and when they come back supposedly from the dead, they have a whole bunch of different interpretations from Christian to Hindu to New Age. And you know that. So there blows the 100 NDEs out of the water.
Not really. I don't think he'd agree with that.
Totally poor means of evidence for the most number one
that most supports his argument.
The thing that Paul says we're pitiable without.
Okay. Well, on your cross on the moon argument.
Let me take some more callers. Thank you for the call. Sorry.
Thanks for a good question. The cross on the moon or something like that kind of question. Personally, I believe the line of philosophical reasoning by people like Pascal and people like that who say that God does not want, if he gave a cross on the moon, if he let Jesus be raised on national television, then he pretty much is saying, y'all aren't going to have any choice. You're all going to come into Christianity. I don't care what you want to be. You're all going to be Christians. You can't deny this. There'll be a few poor souls who would deny it, but there's the cross on the moon. There's the resurrection on CNN. Keep it on your, you know.
Yeah, the cross on the moon kind of sucked because that could have been done with, like, I don't know, a huge laser or something. I don't know. Aliens messing with it? I don't know.
Okay, that's a good point.
I have a much better argument, but go ahead.
But what I mean is, I don't think God, the caller is correct if his assumption is that God is not into giving us the kind of evidence
that
gives nobody a choice. Let me give you a human example.
No, I'm sorry. What do you mean choice, by the way? Choice about what?
Well, for example, when I got married and I decided to have children, I think almost every parent goes through this. You realize you could have children who are to this or to that or problematic here. Or
yes.
If you're Christians, they could become atheists.
You have an idea, but you don't know everything absolutely. But yes.
And listen, a guy could, you know, somebody's children turns into a murderer. I know that, but I still decide to have children.
Well,
because
if you knew though that your child would be a murderer and kill 1,000 people, you probably wouldn't have them.
Well, you think so?
I wouldn't. I mean, would you?
Would you know that ahead of time?
Wouldn't that be immoral to do such a thing? If I did know ahead of time.
Okay, what would I do about it?
Not have the baby.
If God
don't have any sex. I'd be too afraid to have sex.
I'll bet you wouldn't stop. Anyway, that's another subject.
Okay.
Let's say God's in that position.
Mm-hmm.
So God's going to step in and do a quote unquote miracle every single time something's going to go wrong with this creation. Right? What you want to do? You want God to stop Jack the Ripper every time he goes to do something.
Well, in Christian theology, if someone believes that that God is protecting their family through prayer and faith, and Jack the Ripper still rips them up, that...
But what I mean is, we both said earlier, a miracle by definition is something that's rarer than the natural events.
Right. Even in naturalistic terms, you hear even laymen would say, even not in a religious sense, right, they would say, wow, that was a miracle, even though it was just, might have been something just...
Yeah, they mean it's an extraordinary event.
Right, right.
But if God stopped every Jack the Ripper, every drunk driver, every person who's talking on a cell phone when they go through, you know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
We would not be talking about miracles. The world would be a totally different place than it is now. It seems to me the kind of God I believe in is a kind of God who allows possibilities, who gives evidence, but doesn't coerce anybody to believe.
That cannot be really true. I mean, in the Old Testament, Yahweh went down and sat and ate and drank with 72 elders. So he obviously has made himself, he didn't seem to care then.
Oh, wait a minute. He raised Jesus from the dead. What I mean is there are miracles in the Bible. I'm not saying...
Gary, my argument is that I think you're trying to talk about that we wouldn't have a choice if that's the case. Well, he didn't seem to care then. I mean,
because he's talking to people who had already theoretically chosen for him, correct?
Oh, so but
the 72 elders?
But they had to have some type of. I mean, people just don't believe things out of thin air, correct? They have to be exposed to these things, and
right. But
and,
he's appearing to his people.
Right. So,
what I mean is,
but he doesn't, Gary. But he doesn't even appear to Christians today. Aren't they his people?
No, you're saying that to the wrong guy, because I'm going to pull some more evidence. I'm going to pull some more cases out, because I think this world is way bigger. That we have data. We have data
really?
Against naturalism at every
well,
turn.
Well, I mean, I don't understand. Okay, this is the
but
thing.
I mean, I'm not trying to go
but Gary, let's talk about, well, but hold on. 888-503-0802. You're listening to The Infidel Guy Show. Don't forget, you can also Skype me at Infidel Guy, and I will start looking more in the chat room now for your questions. So if I missed them, ladies and gentlemen, please feel free to start doing that right now. I think I have someone in the line, and I'll come back with my point in a minute. Hello, thank you for holding. I'm sorry. Hello.
Reggie, this is Don.
How you doing, Don?
I'm doing all right.
So
I'm listening to this and listening to, you know, what Gary's talking about and all this and this conversation, and it seems to me this is all just, you know, mashed potatoes and corn and broccoli, really. This is a side dish. You know, when we talk about this entire issue, I like to go right for the steak, and that is the existence of the supernatural itself. I mean, it's all fine, well, and good if you want to postulate the supernatural, but you had better actually be able to provide the ontological backing for that claim.
Right.
This is, you know, what Gary is talking about, all this stuff, what theists do, you know, they postulate the supernatural, and it is what one of my friends calls the Pythagorean hangover, that is trying to separate reality into two realms, one that we exist in, and then some other, you know, higher realm. And quite frankly, Gary, you don't have any ontological reason to do this. You have no, you just simply have nothing. You've just got, you know, this is what I'm saying, and that's it.
Don,
so if you would be ever so kind as
sure.
to provide the ontology for the supernatural, I would be grateful.
Okay.
Thank you for the call.
Ontology simply means what is real, what is. It's not, for those of you who haven't studied philosophy, it's not a trick term for something really deep or really, I mean, it's a deep subject. But if there is a resurrection, we started tonight, and Reggie, one of the first questions Reggie asked me was, why did you center on the resurrection? And I said, because it was, I just thought it was different than all the other sorts of religious claims. If a man named Jesus was raised from the dead, and that's a question tonight, if this man named Jesus was raised from the dead, what I'm arguing, Don, is that there is an ontological reality beyond the reality that we see right now. In other words,
yeah.
data for the resurrection would be the ontological reality. But so would, and I mean, I know listeners out there are going to go nuts, but I mean, so would intelligent design, so would near-death experiences, so would a miracle, so would, in other words, somebody would have to grant me this. If those things happen, it would indicate a different ontological realm. So, I mean, to say that I haven't given an ontological underpinning is to miss the fact that what I've been doing tonight is talking about ontology. To say, my argument is, the world is different than many of us think it is. That's where I was going. That is ontology.
All right. I think you called back in. Hello? You're on the air.
Yes, hello?
Oops, very loud. Go ahead.
I had a question. How do we really know that there really was an empty tomb, because I was looking at or listening to some of the statements that were made earlier, and when you talk about the majority of scholars, Bart Ehrman, almost all the members of the Jesus Seminar, Marcus Borg, and so on, all question the presence of a tomb, talking about the common practice of the day was burial in a shallow grave for criminals, even amongst the Jews, which was actually a legal practice, according to the Mishnah, the Talmud, and so on. So, really, all we have in 1 Corinthians 15 is the mention of the death and resurrection. We don't have an empty tomb. We have it partially mentioned in Mark. It seems to be just a progression, a legendary one, which there was more than adequate enough time to do so. What real proof do we have of a tomb?
Okay. Evidence for an empty tomb. By the way, there are a number of scholars down on the left who do believe in empty tomb. I gave an example earlier. The guy's name was Michael Grant. He's the historian who goes after Paul and says Paul didn't have an experience on the way to Damascus, but he says according to historical principles, an empty tomb. Another example is Geza Vermesh, a retired professor of Jewish historical studies at Oxford, who just recently wrote a book on the resurrection of Jesus and argues for an empty tomb. He's not even a Christian. So there are people who are going to argue that. It's not only believers who believe in empty tomb. Now, the question about evidence. When you go through the sources I mentioned earlier tonight, there are more than 20 different arguments for the empty tomb. Now, Reggie, do you want me to pause and mention three or four of these real fast?
Ooh.
I don't want to take more time than you have.
Yeah, it's getting pretty close here.
How much time do we have?
Just another 8 minutes, really, if I can. I'm trying to squeeze these calls in here.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you want me to hold off on arguments for the empty tomb, I'll be glad to come on some other time and we can talk about the empty tomb.
Sure.
But I will just say this. And of course, someone's listening is going to go, well, there he goes again. He's just saying things. But I have a list of 23 arguments for an empty tomb, not that Habermas made up. These come from the list of scholars. I collated these from the list of scholars. There's about five of them that are really, really worth talking about. And because of those, a lot of skeptics, like the fellows that this guy mentioned, people who are going to not believe in a resurrection,
right,
believe in an empty tomb. I'll just leave it right there if that's good enough.
Okay,
for you.
Thank you very much. One more call here. Hello, thank you for holding.
Hello?
Yep, you're on the air.
Hey, this is Eric in Athens. I was just listening to all the points that Dr. Habermas made, and it seems to me that they all depend on the idea that the Bible and the Gospels are reliable history. Would he say that if the Bible is not a reliable history, that the resurrection argument goes out the window?
No. We covered this real early in the discussion, and I would say you could make the argument I'm making and not believe in inspiration, not believe in a reliable Bible. You could even have, I use the example of Homer, you could even have a book that you might conclude is not very reliable historically, and you can still get these 12 facts that I'm working with, because many of the guys I'm talking about, that's their view. Their view is that the Bible is not a good source, and they'll still grant me these 12 facts. So there's no possible way that I'm smuggling in inspiration to get these facts. Because people who are way down to the left who don't believe anything
right,
like inspiration, they would sneer at inspiration, they will still grant these 12 facts. So there's obviously reasons they grant those 12
right,
facts. That's the key, the reasons they grant
okay,
them.
Vincent from the chat room is asking, does Habermas believe Muhammad flew up to heaven on a winged horse? Why or why not?
Well, okay. Now, here I'm going to sound kind of skeptical. I'm going to say, now I've been told by a Muslim friend, I'm open to being corrected by Muslims. But I'm told that that was not supposed to be an historical event, that that was a revelatory event, something that God showed him, like the book of Revelation. That was the example that was actually given to me. So maybe they're not even claiming it's like that. It's not, by the way, that's not after his death. That's not after his death. Muslims, again, I'm open to being corrected, but Muslim believe that Muhammad died. They don't believe he was raised again. So the horse incident did not happen after death. But why don't I believe it? I'm going to sound like Reginald here, but I don't believe it because I don't see any data for it. See, unlike the argument I gave, you'd have to, in my view, you'd have to be committed to the Quran. And if you're committed to the Quran, that's your right, and that's fine. But you'd have to be committed to the Quran to believe that story.
Now, what if there were tons of witnesses that told you they saw an event that isn't theologically consistent for you, or that mirrors?
Like
the gurus in India who can make the sun stand still or make the sun bounce on the atmosphere or things like that, and the thousands of people say they saw it, would you accept their...
Here's where I'm going to apply my own principles to me, and I'm not going to squirm out of this
okay,
one. I would get in there, and I would investigate it with the same fervor that I've gone with resurrection, and if I believe the data say it happened, I would have to make room for it in my worldview. Yes.
Okay.
Heard it here. Yes.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, I don't mean to... Do you mind if I change the subject a little bit to more of God's attributes as opposed to the empiricism and evidence going to which, with
well,
the claims and whatnot?
That might take a 15-minute conversation. I don't know if we... I don't know. It's up to you, Gary. You want to take it really quick? If we can.
Let's hear what.
Because God has quite a number of attributes. So, all right,
yeah,
go ahead.
It's probably going to take us a ways out. But if I can answer quickly, I will.
All right, go ahead, caller.
It's fine. If you want to send a subject, it's fine.
That's your call, Reggie.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead. Well, I think just if you can make what you're going to say quick, go ahead. Right now we're wasting time talking about it. Actually, go ahead.
Okay. My question is, do you believe in free will?
Yes, I do.
Okay, and how do you deal with the argument that with omniscience comes no free will? For example, if we're walking, me and God are just walking down the street and see a quarter on the ground, and God says, hey, you're going to pick up that quarter in 5 minutes. If he knows everything, and he knows everything as a fact, is there anything I can do anything I personally can do so I can make it that I won't pick up that quarter?
Okay. If God knows something's going to happen, it's going to happen because he's omniscient. And like you said, you go, aha, where's the free will? Because let's use your example. God knows I'm going to, here's the way I would say it. There's different, as you know, there are different takes. This is a sovereignty mm-hmm. free will issue, and I'd have a equally committed Christian sitting next to me saying Habermas is wrong. But if God knows you're going to pick up that quarter from all eternity, then you're going to pick up that quarter. But here's the key. You were free not to. You go, well, yeah, okay, I don't want to pick up the quarter. Fine. Then God would know you're not going to pick up the quarter. So here's where I think your catch is. Whatever is going to happen, God knows it. But that doesn't mean I'm not free, because God knows it. On my view, God knows
okay.
it because freely chose it.
I think this is kind of slick. This is what I like to add to it. I think the problem is when we focus just on the omniscience alone. That's not going to work. The fact of the matter is that I know most Christians believe, and some have argued it's biblically supported, that God has he has a determined plan. He has a plan about the universe, the way it's going to, the way it begins, the way it ends, and it's in the Bible. Now, if you add this plan he has for all of mankind plus this omniscience, man simply does not have any free will, because everything is going to end. And imagine this. I take it one step back again, Gary. Before mankind was even created, before there was free will, okay, God already determined exactly the beginning and the ending of mankind. So man might feel like we have free will, but that is completely different aside from...
Are you a determinist, Reggie?
Oh boy, I'm still confused about that one actually. But I would say yes. I'm leaning very, very much toward that. Yes.
Okay. Almost all atheists are. I think that's a fair statement. But in other words, I'm not surprised. But a lot of Christians are too. You know, Calvinists. But let's use the example the fellow used, the quarter. God knows from all eternity whether you will or will not pick up the quarter. Correct.
Not just know it. He also he would plan it.
Okay. Well, let's just put it this way. It's all in one. If God knows it, it will happen, right? Because God couldn't know a false fact, according to where you
are. Of course. In other words, it was set up that way. So, of course, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But you're suggesting that God made you pick up the quarter, therefore you were not free. You were not free to walk past the quarter.
Correct.
Okay. But what if, let's use that reasoning. You're arguing within the kind of a theistic Christian universe here. Does God know Reggie 10 million years before Reggie's born? On this argument.
Of course, yes.
To.
Of
okay.
course. Mm-hmm.
And what happens if God knows Reggie will bypass the quarter and not pick it up? What if God knows, if given the choice, you will not see, not care, not notice, will not pick up the quarter?
It'll be a false choice. That's not even
No,
logical.
No, no. No, if God knows, given that
circumstance, it wouldn't be a real choice in the first place. That's the whole point.
No, no, no. Here's my point. Let's say Reggie can pick up the quarter or not pick up the quarter, and it's up to Reggie, totally up to Reggie. But
that's what we're still trying to determine.
Okay. Well, yeah. I'm just telling you how this can work.
Okay.
If there is choice, then there is no omniscience. That means there's uncertainty.
No. Watch. If Reggie decides to pick up the quarter,
so I think
10 million years ago, God knew Reggie would. That's what omniscience is. 10 million years ago, God knows Reggie's going to pick up the quarter. So guess what? Reggie's going to pick up the quarter. And Reggie goes, no, I'm not free. And God says, no, I made you pick up that quarter because I knew under this circumstance you would do it. Reggie goes, no, I'm not going to pick up the quarter. Well, then 10 million years ago, God would know you weren't going to pick up the quarter, wouldn't he?